Clint Bonti Reading Group. I was about to say Simon Dong again, even after all these months. Yeah, so we're continuing reading The Structure of Behavior. Last couple of sessions in this book, we're in the last chapter. So we're picking up from page 215 of the translation. So yeah, we're still going over the sort of bigger picture results of what's being discussed throughout the rest of this book. So yeah, in the earlier chapters, he's gone through all the sort of technical details of studying the different experiments and what how to interpret their results. And then now we're sort of zooming out and trying to understand what is the relationship between these three orders of reality that he's described: the physical order, the vital order, and the mental order. And he sort of collapses the physical and vital order in this chapter, or he sort of focuses on this the second of those pairs, between the vital and the mental orders. So yeah, the question is, he depicts this question of what the relationship is between these two orders in sort of traditional terms of the relationship between body and soul, which is of course the kind of central problem that Descartes introduces into philosophy. There's a funny line from Sartre, I think one of his autobiographical texts, where he talks about how he studied Descartes in school, and then he wanted to replicate the way that Descartes had distinguished the concepts of body and soul so clearly that no one was ever able to put them back together again. I think that's a funny way of putting it. So this problem of this distinction, or how body and soul, or the physical, or the vital and mental sides of a human being are connected to each other, is what we're sort of dealing with here. And he's looked at a few of the more popular ways of answering this problem, or trying to answer this problem. So one would be the sort of naturalistic side, or a realistic approach to this. So the world that we study in natural science is a world of causal influences of different entities on each other, their forces and interactions and so on. The same types of causal influences would also explain animal and human behavior. Ultimately, the understanding of the sort of final understanding of human behavior would be one in terms of all the causes that bring about that behavior in the nervous system, environmental effects that influence that probably the hormones and so on. But you would bring in all the different causes, and once you master the interaction of all these causes and what kinds of effects they produce, then you would understand human behavior. Of course, he's criticized this sort of causalist approach to studying behavior throughout the book. And one of the sort of main lines of criticism has to do with the sort of holistic nature, or intrinsically structured nature of the stimulus side, or the input to behavior. So the fact that we have this color constancy in our visual perception, for example. So you can't just say that this wavelength of light striking the retina produces this color sensation, and therefore results in pressing the red button versus the blue button, at the level of behavior, because whether the wavelength of light will result in an experience of red or white or whatever depends also on what the ambient lighting of the room is, or of the environment is. So the same wavelength of light striking the retina will be perceived with a different color depending on what the ambient lighting is perceived to be. So you can't just say X wavelength of light produces Y behavior in this experimental setup with the two buttons to press. You have to study the whole environment as this sort of structured system. This is in general the argument against naturalism or causal approaches to behavior, and so he's extending this from these very specific experimental results about color constancy and so on, and pushing that same conceptual framework that you can't sort of isolate individual phenomena that have their own specific causal effects and then add up all those effects to produce the the resulting behavior. And then the other side that he looks at, so like once you sort of recognize the deficiencies of the naturalistic perspective, the sort of opposite approach would be to sort of put all of the like causal processes that we discover in our scientific research sort of on the object side, that like we as scientists sort of, or you know, as people who read about science are sort of standing outside that causal order. And so the causal order that science describes is something that is intellectually constructed. It's something that you think about, you use concepts and inferences and so on to develop a scientific theory. And so all these scientific accounts of the world in terms of the causes and forces and so on, these are all products of an intellectual activity of some kind. And so again, there's like some reasons to not to be that satisfied with this account. And the ones that Merleau Ponty insists on are the way that it sort of minimizes perception or the corporeal aspect of a human being, including the scientists who are doing these kinds of theorizing about the world. So it these accounts sort of treat perception as like an incomplete or confused science, that like when I see a dog running in the field, my experience or the perception of the dog is just a sort of incomplete version of whatever the complete scientific account of dogs would end up being. And so this account sort of doesn't leave any space for something like a positivity of perception, that perception differs from this complete science only in terms of a privation. It's just missing something that the complete science would have. And so there's nothing about perception that is an entity that itself is different from the complete science. So yeah, he wants to sort of focus on the what is positive about perception, what is actually a property or attribute of perception that is not just a lack of completeness that would be filled in as we get closer and closer to that completed science. So that's sort of where we are now in the book. If someone would like to read from first full paragraph on 215.
I can read. The distinction which we are introducing is rather that of the lived and the known. Maybe it's just worth saying quickly that at the end of the last paragraph, he's said that he's not talking about the distinction between sensibility and intelligence or the distinction between form and matter. The distinction which we are introducing is rather that of the lived and the known. The problem of the relations of the soul and body is thus transformed instead of disappearing. Now it will be the problem of the relations of consciousness as flux of individual events, of concrete and resistant structures, and that of consciousness as tissue of ideal significations. The idea of a transcendental philosophy, that is, the idea of consciousness as constituting the universe before it and grasping the objects themselves in indubitable external experience, seems to us to be a definitive acquisition as the first phase of reflection, but is one not obliged to reestablish a duality within consciousness, but is one not obliged to reestablish a duality within consciousness, which is no longer accepted between it and external realities. The objects as ideal unities and as significations are grasped through individual perspectives. When I look at a book placed in front of me, its rectangular form is a concrete and embodied structure. What is the relation between this rectangular, quote-unquote, physiognomy and the signification, quote-unquote, rectangle, which I can make explicit by a logical act? Every theory of perception tries to surmount a well-known contradiction. On the one hand, consciousness is a function of the body. Thus, it is an, quote-unquote, internal event, dependent upon certain external events. On the other hand, these external events themselves are known only by consciousness. In another language, consciousness appears on one hand to be part of the world, and on the other to be coextensive with the world. In the development of methodical knowledge of science, that is, the first observation seems initially to be confirmed. The subjectivity of the secondary qualities seems to have as a counterpart the reality of the primary qualities. But a deeper reflection on the objects of science and on physical causality finds relations in them which cannot be posited in themselves, en soi, and which have meaning only before the inspection of the mind. The antinomy of which we are speaking disappears along with its realistic thesis at the level of reflexive thought, la pensée réfléchie. It is in perceptual knowledge that it has its proper location. Until now, critical thought seemed to us to be incontestable. It shows marvelously that the problem of perception does not exist for a consciousness which adheres to objects of reflexive thought, that is, to significations. It is subsequently that it seems necessary to leave it. Having in this way referred the antinomy of perception to the order of life, as Descartes says, or to the order of confused thought, one pretends to show that it has no consistency there. If perception conceptualizes itself ever so little and knows what it is saying, it reveals that the experience of passivity is also a construction of the mind. Realism is not even based on a coherent appearance. It is an error. One wonders, then, what can provide consciousness with the very notion of passivity, and why this notion is confused with its body if these natural errors rest on no authentic experience and possess strictly no meaning whatsoever. We've tried to show that, as a matter of fact, to the extent that the scientific knowledge of the organism becomes more precise, it becomes impossible to give a coherent meaning to the alleged action of the world on the body and of the body on the soul. The body and the soul are significations and have meaning, then, only with regard to a consciousness. So one thing that's sometimes difficult for me to, he'll often present a position which is sometimes kind of mixed up with his own final position, and then, refute it, set it up to refute it a couple of pages later. I think that this apparent antinomy between the signification rectangle of the book and the book's perspectival appearance to me is that I think that there is going to be a real difference between these two ways of knowing the book for Merleau-Ponty. Even if the signification is sort of founded on the perception. But then when he talks about this understanding of transcendental philosophy where passivity or receptivity would have no meaning, he seems pretty clearly to be setting this up as something that he will refute later, because it seems like he's laying out again this intellectualist approach where, you know, it's the body and soul, as he says, are only significations. So I guess what his position on that will be something like receptivity is just this perception, which, as we've discussed, has positive reality. Signification is real as well, but without a reduction of the reality of the perceptual situation.
Yeah, throughout the book, but I think especially in this last chapter, he's engaged in a kind of dialectical exercise in the sense of dialogue, closer to the Platonic sense of dialectic, that he's like presenting different positions and sort of playing them off each other and seeing how each of them, sort of evolves in its relationship with the other position. So that does make it difficult sometimes to determine when he's sort of speaking in his own voice and when he's like giving voice to someone else's argument that he's going to, show the limitations of on the next page. But I think that's also part of what he's the form of the exposition is not sort of external to what he's sort of trying to present, in a sense that our grasp of any kind of signification, including the sort of simple perceptual ones, the fact that the fire truck is red or whatever, also involves this kind of working through of something, bringing it into a conceptual form and making it something that is expressible and graspable. So in the same way that, like, to understand a philosophical position, we have to sort of, we can't just sort of like set it out from these self-evident axioms and have this like crystallized theory that you can like just grasp in one shot. Instead, you have to you have to sort of work through the different positions as they like develop each other, as they sort of push each other forward. So yeah, I think that like experience of you know, working through these sort of slightly confusing passages is like sort of a model or like an analogy with the experience of, you know, maybe a child or someone like learning for the first time how to identify red objects. No pistol shot absolute. Yeah. Like Hegel's famous objection to Schelling, though he didn't, explicitly name him. So you can't just grasp, you know, the way the world is in sort of this one act of intellectual intuition. You have to, even though there is, of course, this grasp of a structure, this melodic experience that he's talked about, you can't that melody or that sort of structure is something that you have to develop. You have to sort of unfold what is all contained in that structure, and there's no end to that unfolding. Sorry, we're just having fun in the chat here with the crystal emojis, and it makes me think of that movie, the Dark Crystal. You remember that movie from the 80s with like the puppets and everything? Anyway, sorry. I got distracted by crystals. this like whole sort of experience of taking something, this sort of obscure like grasp of this complicated structure that you then, you know, spend potentially a lifetime trying to unroll and disentangle. I think that's like sort of like if you were going to sort of encapsulate Merleau-Ponty's whole approach to like philosophy in like one sentence, I think that would be a pretty good way of doing it. And you can think of like, you have like scholars of religious texts that, for example, that like they might like spend decades like just focusing on like one verse from a religious text and like trying to figure out what, you know, all the meaning that you can derive from that one text or that one verse. That's not like limited to the religious sphere or a sphere of written texts. That's like characteristic of anything that has a signification for Merleau-Ponty, and that, you know, signification is characteristic of everything about our experience as human beings. So like in, of course, the scientific world, you can take, you know, even like simple phenomena like we were just talking before we started recording about like this relatively recent development of hydrodynamic analogies for quantum mechanics. So like the simple things involving droplets of oil, like in the book I just started reading that we were talking about, he's saying some of these experiments can be like the apparatus cost like $50 to put together, like some oil and like a little pan to put it in and so on. These are not like, you know, particle accelerators that cost many billions of dollars and, you know, thousands of technicians to construct and operate. You can take these like very simple phenomena and like, you know, spend a career just investigating these, you know, what exactly is happening, how these phenomena arise, you know, what you can learn from them, etc. This is like this experience of taking something obscure and making it comprehensible is I think like part of the whole enterprise of like human existence for Merleau-Ponty. Maybe our crystal exercise with the emojis is also something that we can like spend our lifetimes elucidating the meaning of. We can see how many meanings we can find for each emoji. Let's go on to the next passage if someone else would like to read.
Yeah, I can read. We are in From Our Point of View, right? In 216.
Yes.
Okay. Just making sure. From our point of view also, the realistic thesis of common sense disappears at the level of reflexive thought, which encounters only significations in front of it. The experience of passivity is not explained by an actual passivity, but it should have a meaning and be able to be understood. As philosophy, realism is an error because it transposes into the dogmatic thesis an experience which it deforms or renders impossible by that very fact. But it is a motivated error. It rests on an authentic phenomenon which philosophy has the function of making explicit. The proper structure of perceptual experience, the reference of partial quote-unquote profiles to the total signification which they quote-unquote present would be this phenomenon. Indeed, the alleged bodily conditioning of perception, taken in its actual meaning, requires nothing more and nothing less than this phenomenon in order to be understood. We have seen that excitations and nerve influxes are abstractions and that science links them to a total functioning of the nervous system in the definition of which the phenomenal is implied. The perceived is not an effect of cerebral functioning. It is its signification. All the consciousnesses which we know present themselves in this way through a body, which is their perspectival aspect. But, after all, its individual dialectic has cerebral stages, as it were, of which it itself knows nothing. The signification of nerve functioning has organic bases, which do not figure in. Philosophically, this fact admits of the following translation. It's time that a certain sensible phenomena are actualized in my field of consciousness. A properly placed observer would see certain other phenomena in my brain, which cannot be given to me myself in the mode of actuality. In order to understand these phenomena, he would be led to grant them, as we did in Chapter 2, a signification which would concur with the content of my perception. Inversely, I can represent for myself in the virtual mode, that is, as pure significations, certain retinal and cerebral phenomena which I localize in a virtual image of my body, on the basis of the actual view which is given to me. The fact that the spectator and myself are both bound to our bodies comes down in sum to this, that which can be given to me in the mode of actuality as a concrete perspective is given to him only in the mode of virtuality as a signification, and conversely. In sum, my total psychophysical being, that is, the experience which I have of myself, that which others have of me, and the scientific knowledge which they and I apply to that knowledge of myself, is an interlacing of significations such that, when certain among them are perceived and passed into actuality, the others are only virtually intended. But this structure of experience is similar to that of external objects. Even more, they mutually presuppose each other. If there are things for me, that is, perspectival beings, reference to a point from which I see them is included in their perspectival character itself. But to be situated within a certain point of view necessarily involves not seeing that point of view itself, not possessing it as a visual object except in a virtual signification. Therefore, the existence of an external perception, that of my body and, quote-unquote, in this body, the existence of phenomena which are imperceptible for me, are rigorously synonymous. There is no relation of causality between them. They are concordant phenomena. One often speaks as if the perspectival character of perception were explained by the projection of objects on my retina. I see only three sides of a cube because I see with my eyes. Where a projection of only these three sides is possible, I do not see objects which are behind me because they are not projected on my retina. But the converse could be said just as well. Indeed, what are, quote-unquote, my eyes, quote-unquote, my retina, quote-unquote, the external cube in itself, and, quote-unquote, the objects which I do not see? They are logical significations which are bound up with my actual perception of invalid, quote-unquote, grounds, and which explicitate its meaning, but which get the index of real existence from it. These significations do not have in themselves, therefore, the means to explain the actual existence of my perception. The language which one habitually uses is nevertheless understandable. My perception of the cube presents it to me as a complete and real cube. My perception of space as a space which is complete and real beyond the aspects which are given to me. Thus, it is natural that I have a tendency to detach the space and the cube from the concrete perspectives and to posit themselves, and to posit them in themselves. En soi. Should I maybe stop here?
This might be one of these passages with like just a long sort of series of ideas with no like natural stopping point. So yeah, we can stop anywhere, I think. In relation with perception, he's sort of taking perception as like this problem case that these two positions, this like causalist position and intellectualist position, both sort of are inadequate to make sense of, and this kind of duality in perception is also kind of incarnated, or in a sense, literally incarnated in our bodies, in the sense that, you know, of course, we can perceive our bodies. You know, I can look at my hand. My hand is the object of perception, but also my hand is not just an object in the same way that, like, the desk is an object that I can perceive. The hand is also, you know, part of what I am as the subject. There's this, you know, the famous passage in the Phenomenology of Perception about, you know, touching one hand with the other, that you can sort of alternately shift your attention in such a way that one hand is the touching hand and the other hand is the touched hand. You can just sort of, you know, swap the roles of the two hands. But there's this sort of duality of the, you know, the active side that is doing the touching, and then the passive side of what is being touched. And this is sort of a property of the body in general, not just of, you know, the specific phenomenon of one hand touching the other, but like we were talking, I think, last time about that passage from Wittgenstein, where he says about how strange it is that we just sort of assume that, you know, the people that we interact with actually have a brain inside their skull and not sawdust, even though, of course, we in general have not opened up that skull to see the brain, and we have no, like, specific evidence that there is a brain in there. We just, you know, out of our sort of general knowledge of how human bodies work, we suppose that there's a brain, although in some cases there's a greater degree of evidence than others. All these aspects of the world that we aspects of our bodies that we sort of, you know, we can treat our bodies as objects that we can, you know, have scientific knowledge about. Like, I can learn about kidneys and then come to have, you know, beliefs about my own kidney, and, like, what, you know, how my kidneys work and so on. But, like, I'm not sort of perceiving, or my kidneys are not something that I, like, experience as, you know, part of myself in the same way that I, you know, experience, say, like, soreness in my muscles after, you know, lifting weights or whatever. You can sort of treat your body in these two different ways in experience, or you know, your body has these two different aspects of that can each be sort of presented in experience. But I think what he's sort of building up to, or trying to get at, is that there's, like, these two aspects, or these two sides of the body, are, like, each sort of a partial refraction of something that is itself prior to those two sides, or more fundamental than those two sides. So, like, the, you know, viewing your body as an object, you know, looking at your hand and studying what, you know, properties it has and so on. Or on the other hand, you know, that sort of internal experience of, you know, moving your hand or doing things with that hand. These are both sort of partial reflections or partial aspects of the sort of fundamental unity of your hand as part of this living, signifying, you know, activity ongoing in the world, that is a human existence. I think that's sort of where we're headed, even though the path to get there is not a linear one. It involves a lot of detours. And just sort of building on what Bats posted in the chat here. In some of the passages we read last week, and then he just sort of alludes to it here. He's talking about, like, the perspectival character of perception. So the fact that when I look at a cube, I only see three sides of the cube sort of presented to me. And even though each of those sides is a square, when I look at them, they are sort of a parallelogram in terms of the perspectival presentation of each of those sides, you know, because each side is sort of distorted in terms of the proportions in relation to perception. But then at the same time, when I see this perspectival, or this, you know, view of a cube, this perspective on a cube, I don't see it as, like, a weird arrangement of parallelograms. I see it as a cube. And it's actually quite difficult to, you know, make yourself see the parallelograms and learn how to draw them accurately. So seeing these parallelograms arranged in this way is how you see a cube, you know, and you always are seeing a cube from a perspective. There's no such thing as a perception of a cube that wouldn't be from a perspective. where you would see all six sides at once and each of them as a square. So each of these sides, you know, the perspectival vision of the cube, you know, as this presentation of three parallelograms, and then the awareness that the cube actually is composed of six squares as opposed to three parallelograms, these two aspects are intrinsically connected to each other in that you can only see the cube as having six sides by means of the three parallelograms, and you only see the three parallelograms as a cube because you are also aware of it as, you know, having six square sides. So like someone who did not have the capacity to view the three parallelograms as a cube would have a different experience than we do seeing the cube. And there have been some, I think it's more like anecdotal evidence, not like sort of systematic studies, but like some people in isolated communities like New Guinea Highlands or you know, in the Amazon or wherever, that you know, they live in places where most of the environment is not you know, human constructed buildings with straight lines, but it's you know, a sort of deep forest environment, that their perception of like geometrical shapes and especially like drawings and so on is quite different than ours. So these people, you know, if you showed them a cube and especially like a line drawing of a cube, may not actually recognize it as a cube in the way that we would. So yeah, they would see like an arrangement of parallelograms, and so yeah, their experience, even if you have like exactly the same projection onto that person's retina as you know, a typical, you know, Western psych student who is like the standard object of study in psychology, you have the exact same retinal projection, but the experience would be entirely different because their way of making sense of that is different. So yeah, all this to say that these two sides of perception as like grasping something as it really is, you know, grasping the cube as having six sides, and the perspective through which you see it are intrinsically connected to each other, and you can't separate them from each other and like only grasp the cube as it is in itself, for example.
One thing I still don't fully understand is in an earlier chapter, he talked about how when he was talking about linear causal chains as sort of abstractions, it doesn't seem like he's, you know, denying that there is a truth to the realistic idea that there is a world out there which is not, you know, can't only be understood in terms of our perception of it. And yet, I guess I'm having trouble formulating this, but the exact relation between the cerebral processes, which the reality of which he seems to, you know, be fully willing to admit, and perception as, I guess, the index of reality, or the other side of the antinomy in which, you know, perception is in a sense where the cerebral processes take place insofar as they crystallize into significations from some perceptual situation. Later on, I think, I mean, in a kind of poetic turn of phrase, he says that there's this kind of magical passage between them, which is, it's an interesting way to put it, but it's, you know, it's not a real explanation of the relation between them. But I don't know, there's this cool sense that I get that I, you know, it's not something that's explicit in the text, but there's this, I guess, a picture of the cosmos as this kind of single thing, which is, you know, from which linear causal processes can only be known, can only be abstracted. And so, as he said earlier, each part really interacts on all of the others. And yet within it, there are these, I think in an earlier chapter, he talked about how like the world, a world opens up when an animal begins to perceive. And yet that perception is, it's like a kind of spatialization and temporalization, which isn't really anywhere in three-dimensional space. Yeah, I guess there are two points in there. One is that I'm not totally sure what the relation between the two sides of the antinomy is, and the other is that, this idea of a kind of monism in which there is also experience as something that is not strictly speaking, or not completely reducible to physical causality, is kind of a cool idea.
Yeah, I think you're definitely right that he's not saying that, like, so he's given a lot of criticisms of, like, certain types of neurological explanations. And, you know, there wasn't really such a thing as neuroscience as such at this time, but, like, you know, physiological explanations of behavior in terms of, you know, the functioning of the nervous system, for example. But he's not, of course, denying that, like, you know, the nervous system exists, or that it has a role in you know, how behavior is governed and so on, or even that, like, studying the physiology of the nervous system can help us learn about behavior. So, like, one of his sort of key sources that he's talked about throughout this book is Goldstein, who, you know, was a physiologist a neurologist who dealt with patients who had suffered brain damage, and, you know, tried to understand what the effect of that brain damage was on their behavior. He's definitely not, you know, opposed to, like, a scientific approach to behavior and studying it in terms of causes, but he wants to situate that causal understanding of behavior, or maybe put it in a different way, he wants to take that study of the causes or the causal processes that are involved in behavior as one side of this sort of process of signification. When you study, you know, how it is that someone is able to write their name on a piece of paper, for example, you can look at, you know, what kinds of nerve impulses are being transmitted down the nerves in the person's arm, and you can, you know, stick them in fMRI and look at which regions of the brain are especially active while they're doing this, and so on. And you can learn lots of things about, you know, how that is happening, but you also need to sort of understand, you know, that this behavior of writing your name is something different than just sort of moving your hand in maybe even the exact same pattern of motion, but, like, you know, not having the paper underneath the pen, that there's, like, a signification of writing your name that is not not present in the second case. The causal, or the study of the causal processes that are part of behavior is only one side of the study of behavior, and is incomplete without, you know, grasping the signification of that behavior. And these attempts to sort of, like, the sort of bottom-up approaches that are, you know, generally quite popular in physiology or physiological approaches to behavior, that you would, like, start from the sort of basic level of, like, in a neuroscientific approach, you would start from, like, you know, how exactly is an action potential brought about in a neuron, how, you know, the permeability of the membrane to different types of ions, and pumping sodium and potassium across the membrane, and so on. You sort of start from this very basic level, and then, you know, the idea is you would just sort of build that up into bigger and bigger components that would eventually give you an understanding of, like, human behavior as such. There's, like, a lot of steps in between that are, not exactly filled in at this point. Merleau-Ponty is suggesting here that this is not just sort of an accident that, like, we haven't, you know, done neuroscience for long enough to, you know, be able to explain, like, the history of, like, ancient Egypt in terms of, like, the neuroscientific principles that were involved. This is, like, an in principle difficulty, or an in principle problem, that it's not actually possible to, like, you know, just fill in all these gaps in this kind of strategy and then get to, like, a complete understanding of everything about human existence. You instead have to, like, have some sort of grasp of the signification of, like, going back to the ancient Egypt example, you'd have to, like, understand what are the, you know, religious practices and beliefs of this society, you know, how is their economy organized, all these things that would be understood in terms of significations. And then you could also look at, you know, what kinds of neuroscientific what kinds of processes are going on in the brains of people who are engaged in this kind of religious practice, for example. You could probably learn lots of interesting things, but you would have to, like, you can't sort of avoid the treatment of those religious practices as something that has a signification, or you can't like sort of grasp that signification purely in terms of like starting out from those causal processes and then sort of like reconstruct the whole thing from there. So that, I think that's like the distinction between like, yeah, rejecting physiology or causation in general and versus like rejecting the assumption that we can sort of explain the entirety of human existence in terms of these causal processes.
Yeah, maybe it's because I was reading about Schelling and Spinoza recently, but I don't know, it does seem like there's this kind of unity of the real and the ideal, that these, you have these two sides to these processes that are irreducible, have to be brought together into this kind of synoptic picture. Yeah, it's, I guess, a kind of, in that sense, a kind of, maybe there are connections that could be drawn with, like, absolute idealism.
Yeah, I mean, I think you can probably trace just about anything in philosophy since the beginning of the 19th century, you know, back to German idealism in one way or another. Well, maybe not like Russell's On Denoting, or, well, I mean, he does mention Hegelians at one point in that paper, but just to make a joke about them. Merleau-Ponty, yeah, he's talked about Hegel quite a bit in this book, and a lot of what he's describing here is quite Hegelian. I don't think it's a stretch to want to sort of translate what he's talking about here in terms of this, yeah, unity of the real and the ideal. Sorry, we're just having a side conversation in the chat here. Sorry for the people in the recording. Just give me a second. We're just comparing participial clauses in different languages in case anyone is curious. So I think we can go on to the next bit. If someone else would like to read. Bats, do you have a mic set up if you would be able to read?
I think Bats read last.
Sorry, you did. Yes. Angus, maybe if you could read the next one then.
Yeah, it's at 218, I think, the middle paragraph.
Okay, thanks. I was about to ask. Thanks, Bats. The same operation takes place with respect to the body. And as a consequence, I'm naturally inclined to engender perception by an operation of the cube. The same operation takes place with respect to the body. As a consequence, I am naturally inclined to engender perception by an operation of the cube or of objective space on my objective body. This attempt is natural, but its failure is no less inevitable. As we have seen, one cannot reconstitute the structure of perceptual experience by combining ideal significations, stimuli, receptors, associative circuits. But if physiology does not explain perception, optics and geometry do not explain it either. To imagine that I see my image in the mirror because the light waves form a certain angle in reaching my eyes, and because I situate their origin at the point of coincidence, is to make the use of mirrors during so many centuries when optics was not yet invented mysterious indeed. The truth is that man first sees his image, quote unquote, through the mirror, without the word yet having taken the signification which it will take on vis-a-vis the geometrical mind. Then he constructs a geometrical representation of this phenomenon, which is founded on the concrete articulations of the perceived field, which makes them explicit and accounts for them, without the representation ever being able to be the cause of the concrete articulations, as realism wants to do, and without our being able to substitute it for them, as critical idealism does. Access to the proper domain of perception has been rendered difficult for all philosophies which, because of a retrospective illusion, actualized a natural geometry in perception on the pretext that it has been possible to construct a geometry of perceived objects. The perception of a distance or a size is not the same as the quantitative estimations by which science makes distance and size precise. All the sciences situate themselves in a quote-unquote complete and real world without realizing that perceptual experience is constituting with respect to this world. Thus, we find ourselves in the presence of a field of lived perception which is prior to number, measure, space, and causality, and which is nonetheless given only as a perspectival view of objects gifted with stable properties, a perspectival view of an objective world and an objective space. The problem of perception consists in trying to discover how the intersubjective world, the determinations of which science is gradually making precise, is grasped through this field. The antinomy of which we spoke above is based upon this ambiguous structure of perceptual experience. The thesis and the antithesis express the two aspects of it. It is true to say that my perception is always a flux of individual events, and that what is radically contingent in the lived perspectivism of perception accounts for the realistic appearance. But it is also true to say that my perception accedes to things themselves, for these perspectives are articulated in a way which makes access to inter-individual significations possible. They quote-unquote present a world. Thus there are things exactly in the sense in which I see them, in my history and outside it, and inseparable from this double relation. I perceive things directly without my body forming a screen between them and me. It is a phenomenon just as they are, phenomenon gifted, it is true, with an original structure, which precisely presents the body to me as an intermediary between the world and myself, although it is not a matter of fact. I see with my eyes, which are not an ensemble of transparent or opaque tissues and organs, but the instruments of my looking. The retinal image, to the extent that I know it, is not yet produced by the light waves issuing from the object. But these two phenomena resemble and correspond to each other in a magical way across an interval which is not yet space. We are returning to the givens of naive consciousness, which we were analyzing at the beginning of this chapter. Philosophy of perception is not ready-made in life. We have just seen that it is natural for consciousness to misunderstand itself precisely because it is consciousness of things. The classical discussions centering around perception are a sufficient testimony to this natural error. The constituted world is confronted with the perceptual experience of the world, and one either tries to engender perception from the world, as realism does, or else to see in it only a commencement of the science of the world, as critical thought does. To return to perception as to a type of original experience in which the real world is constituted in its specificity is to impose upon oneself an inversion of the natural movement of consciousness. On the other hand, every question has not been eliminated. It is a question of understanding, without confusing it with a logical relation, the lived relation of the quote-unquote profiles to the quote-unquote things which they present, of the perspectives to the ideal significations which are intended through them. The problem which Malebranche tried to resolve by occasionalism, or Leibniz by pre-established harmony, is carried over into human consciousness. Yeah, so most of this is a surprisingly clear summary statement of the argument in this chapter. He seems to be saying at the end here that here was the passage I was talking about, the two phenomena, so the realism of perspectival appearance and the idealism of signification resemble and correspond to each other in a magical way across an interval which is not yet space. Incidentally, I think this is exactly what Deleuze is talking about when he talks about thought moving at infinite speed. But at least so far, he seems to be saying that this is kind of an open problem, or one that he hasn't fully addressed yet, and that, you know, it's a problem of what exactly guarantees the correspondence between the ideal signification and the real perceived. And I know that in the beginning of the conclusion, he's going to talk a bit about even a kind of positivity to illusion and hallucination, which kind of presents a problem for the question of the relation between these two sides.
Yeah, so he's sort of getting us to the conclusion of this book. So he's bringing things together that he's, you know, presented throughout the previous chapters. And so again, we have this sort of antinomy of like of perception. So he talks about this like natural geometry. So it's like we can. So if you wanted to, or if, you know, there are specific reasons to do this, you can like measure all the objects in your apartment. You can like, you know, figure out what size they have, what the angles are to like between your eye and the object, and so on. So there's nothing sort of illegitimate about doing this or illusory about doing this. But what is the illusion is the sort of retroactive assumption that those like angles and sizes that you measured are sort of that they underlie your perception that you started from. So the fact that you can go from a perceptual experience to this geometrized or this measured or scientific depiction of the world doesn't mean that that scientific depiction of the world is actually sort of more fundamental or prior to that perceptual experience. And again, it's also like I was talking about before, that it doesn't mean, of course, you know, rejecting that priority of this scientific depiction of the world doesn't mean that the scientific depiction of the world is itself an illusion. So sort of denouncing the sort of illusory retroactive prioritization of the geometrical world doesn't mean that the geometrical world itself is an illusion. So we have to see each of these sides of experience as sort of implicitly or sorry intrinsically connected to each other, that experience always has this ambiguity or this double-sided character to it, that you can sort of go in the direction, you can take the experience and make it into something objective that you can measure in certain ways, or you can sort of retreat from that objective nature of experience. But these are sort of always two paths that you can take from any given experience. But the experience itself is prior to, you know, the result of taking either of those two paths. Okay, so we can go on to the next bit. I think it's probably my turn to read. Sorry, let me find where we... Angus, what was the last paragraph you read?
We stopped right before the conclusion on 220.
Okay, right, yes. Okay, like we just have I think the conclusion is only a couple pages, so we can probably, we should be able to get through it today. Okay, and then we will be done the book. Right, so I will read from the conclusion. Okay, yet until now, we have considered only the perspectivism of true perception, instances in which lived experience appears closed with a signification which breaks apart, so to speak, in the course of subsequent experience and is not verified by concordant syntheses, would still have to be analyzed. We have not accepted the causal explanation which naturalism provides in order to account for this subjectivity in the second degree, what is called bodily, psychological, or social determinism in hallucination and error has appeared to us to be reducible to the emergence of imperfect dialectics or of partial structures. But why, in extendo, does such a dialectic at the organic vegetative level break up a more integrated dialectic as happens in hallucination? Consciousness is not only and not always consciousness of truth. How are we to understand the inertia and the resistance of the inferior dialectics which stand in the way of the advent of the pure relations of impersonal subject and true object and which affect my knowledge with a coefficient of subjectivity? How are we to understand the adherence of fallacious signification to the lived, which is constitutive of illusion? We have rejected Freud's causal categories and replaced his energic metaphors with structural metaphors. But although the complex is not a thing outside of consciousness which would produce its effects in it, although it is only a structure of consciousness, at least the structure tends, as it were, to conserve itself. It has been said that what is called unconsciousness is only an inapperceived signification. It may happen that we ourselves do not grasp the true meaning of our life, not because an unconscious personality is deep within us and governs our actions, but because we understand our lived states only through an idea which is not adequate for them. But even unknown to us, the efficacious law of our life is constituted by its true signification. Everything happens as if this signification directed the flux of mental events. Thus, it will be necessary to distinguish their ideal signification, which can be true or false, and their immanent signification, or, to employ a clearer language, which we will use from now on, their ideal signification and their actual structure. I like how he introduces a new terminological distinction in the last, like, three pages of this book. Sorry. Anyway, correlatively, it will be necessary to distinguish in development an ideal liberation on the one hand, which does not transform us in our being and changes only the consciousness which we have of ourselves, and on the other hand, a real liberation, which is the Umgestaltung of which we spoke along with Goldstein. We are not reducible to the ideal consciousness which we have of ourselves any more than the existent thing is reducible to the signification by which we express it. It is easy to argue in the same way, in opposition to the sociologist, that the structures of consciousness, which he relates to a certain economic structure, are in reality the consciousness of a certain structure of certain structures. This argument hints at a liberty very close to mind, capable by reflection of grasping itself as spontaneous source and naturizing from below the contingent forms with which it has clothed itself in a certain milieu. Like Freud's complex, the economic structure is only one of the objects of a transcendental consciousness. But quote, transcendental consciousness, unquote, the full consciousness of self is not ready-made. It is to be achieved, that is, realized and existent. In opposition to Durkheim's, quote, collective consciousness, unquote, and his attempts at sociological explanations of knowledge, it is rightly argued that consciousness cannot be treated as an effect, since it is that which constitutes the relation of cause and effect. But between a causal thinking which can be all too easily challenged, there is a truth of sociologism. Collective consciousness does not produce categories, but neither can one say that collective representations are only the objects of a consciousness which is always free in their regard. Only the consciousness in a quote-unquote we of an object of consciousness in an I. It's a somewhat difficult sentence to understand. Have to come back to that. The mental, we have said, is reducible to the structure of behavior. Since this structure is visible from the outside and for the spectator at the same time as from within and for the actor, another person is in principle accessible to me as I am to myself, and we are both objects laid out before an impersonal consciousness. But just as I can be mistaken concerning myself and grasp only the apparent or ideal signification of my conduct, so can I be mistaken concerning another and know only the envelope of his behavior. The perception which I have of him is never, in the case of suffering or mourning, for example, the equivalent of the perception which he has of himself, unless I'm sufficiently close to him that our feelings constitute together a single quote-unquote form, and that our lives cease to flow separately. It is by this rare and difficult consent that I can be truly united with him, just as I can grasp my natural movements and know myself sincerely, only by the decision to belong to myself. Thus, I do not know myself because of my special position, but neither do I have the innate power of truly knowing another. I communicate with him by the signification of his conduct, but it is a question of attaining its structure, that is, of attaining, beyond his words or even his actions, the region where they are prepared. As we have seen, the behavior of another expresses a certain manner of existing before signifying a certain manner of thinking. And when this behavior is addressed to me, as may happen in dialogue, it seizes upon my thoughts in order to respond to them, or more simply, when the, quote, cultural objects, unquote, which fall under my regard, suddenly adapt themselves to my powers, awaken my intentions, and make themselves, quote-unquote, understood by me, I'm then drawn into a coexistence of which I'm not the unique constituent and which founds the phenomenon of social nature as perceptual experience founds that of physical nature. Consciousness can live in existing things without reflection, can abandon itself to their concrete structure, which has not yet been converted into expressible signification. Certain episodes of its life, before having been reduced to the condition of available memories and inoffensive objects, can imprison its liberty by their proper inertia, shrink its perception of the world, and impose stereotypes on behavior. Likewise, before having conceptualized our class or a milieu, we are that class or that milieu. Thus the, quote, I think, unquote, can be as if hallucinated by its objects. It will be replied, which is true, that it, quote, should be able, unquote, to accompany all our representations, and that it is presupposed by them, if not as term of an act of actual consciousness, at least as a possibility in principle. But this response to critical philosophy poses a problem. The conversion of seeing, which transforms the life of consciousness into a pure dialectic of subject and object, which reduces the thing in sensible density to a bundle of significations, the traumatic reminiscence into an indifferent memory, and submits the class structure of my consciousness to examination. Does this conversion make explicit an eternal, quote, condition of possibility, unquote, or does it bring about the appearance of a new structure of consciousness? It is a problem to know what happens, for example, when consciousness disassociates itself from time, from this uninterrupted gushing forth at the center of itself, in order to apprehend it as an intellectual and manipulable signification. Does it lay bare only what was implicit? Or, on the contrary, does it not enter as into a lucid dream in which indeed it encounters no opaqueness, not because it has clarified the existence of things and its own existence, but because it lives at the surface of itself and on the envelope of things? Is the reflexive passage to intellectual consciousness an adequation of our knowing to our being, or only a way for consciousness to create for itself a separated existence, a quietism? These questions express no empiricist demand, no complacence for experiences which would not have to account for themselves. On the contrary, we want to make consciousness equal with the whole of experience, to gather into consciousness for itself, pour soi, all the life of consciousness in itself, en soi. A philosophy in the critical tradition founds moral theory on a reflection which discovers the thinking subject in his liberty behind all objects. If, however, one acknowledges, be it in the status of phenomenon, an existence of consciousness and of its resistant structures, our knowledge depends upon what we are. Moral theory begins with a psychological and sociological critique of oneself. Man is not assured ahead of time of possessing a source of morality. Consciousness of self is not given in man by right. It is acquired only by the elucidation of his concrete being and is verified only by the active integration of isolated dialectics, body and soul, between which it is initially broken up. And finally, death is not deprived of meaning, since the contingency of the lived is a perpetual menace for the eternal significations in which it is believed to be completely expressed. It will be necessary to assure oneself that the experience of eternity is not the unconsciousness of death, that it is not on this side but beyond. Similarly, moreover, it will be necessary to distinguish the love of life from the attachment to biological existence. The sacrifice of life will be philosophically impossible. It will be a question only of, quote, staking one's life, which is a deeper way of living. If one understands by perception the act which makes us know existences, all the problems which we have just touched on are reducible to the problem of perception. It resides in the duality of the notions of structure and signification. A, quote, form, unquote, such as the structure of, quote, figure and ground, unquote, for example, is a whole which has a meaning and which provides, therefore, a base for intellectual analysis. But at the same time, it is not an idea. It constitutes, alters, and reorganizes itself before us like a spectacle. The alleged bodily, social, and psychological, quote, causalities, unquote, are reducible to this contingency of lived perspectives, which limit our access to eternal significations. The, quote, horizontal localizations, unquote, of cerebral functioning, the adhesive structures of animal behavior and those of pathological behavior are only particularly striking examples of this. Quote-unquote structure is the philosophical truth of naturalism and realism. What are the relations of this naturized consciousness and the pure consciousness of self? Can one conceptualize perceptual consciousness without eliminating it as an original mode? Can one maintain specificity without rendering inconceivable its relation to intellectual consciousness? If the essence of the critical solution consists in driving existence back to the limits of knowledge and of discovering intellectual signification in concrete structure, and if, as has been said, the fate of critical thought is bound up with this intellectualist theory of perception, in the event that this were not acceptable, it would be necessary to define transcendental philosophy anew in such a way as to integrate with it the very phenomenon of the real. The natural, quote-unquote, thing, the organism, the behavior of others and my own behavior exist only by their meaning. But this meaning which springs forth in them is not yet a Kantian object. The intentional life which constitutes them is not yet a representation. And the, quote-unquote, comprehension which gives access to them is not yet an intellection. And that is the end of the book. So he like jams in like the material of like 20 books worth of things in like 3 pages at the end here. Like, I think this is like an experience that many of us probably have had in like undergrad essays where you have like your plan for what you want to write. And the first 2 points end up taking the 15 pages or whatever that you're supposed to write. And then the last 5 points end up being crammed in the last paragraph as like, this is a topic for a future paper or whatever. So I think that might have been what happened here. I mean, all these things are things that he, you know, goes on to develop in the rest of his career. So yeah, anyway, it was it wasn't like intellectual laziness or something that led him to, you know, cram everything in here. It's just that he had like so many different things he wanted to develop out of these ideas that he's presenting that, you know, he just didn't really have space to set them out in this one relatively short book. And I think also like some of what he's discussing here has to do with like how we can understand the distinction between this criticist position or Kantian position in relation to the transcendental the analysis of the transcendental structures of consciousness and then the Hegelian position, because I think what is sort of, or at least one of the points that is sort of distinctive of Hegel's approach in the phenomenology compared to Kant beforehand, is this recognition that, doing this kind of transcendental analysis of experience, so like passing from this perspective of, empirical realism where you just see the table as this thing outside you, and then passing to this, transcendental perspective on the table as, something that is constituted in your consciousness. This transition is itself something that happens in an actual historical change, that like you haven't just from outside the world changed your angle of view on the world. You have actually introduced something into the world that didn't exist before. This new entity that you are doing this transcendental analysis of perception is a new thing that didn't exist before that now exists in the world. And so this like passage from the empirical realist to the transcendental idealist position is itself a phenomenon that you have to study, and you have to explain this transition and understand how it happens and so on. So like when we do philosophy, when we try to extract the signification out of some phenomenon, whether it's rats navigating a maze or physicists coming up with an explanation for oil droplets or whatever it is, we are not just standing outside the world and changing the way that we interpret it, but we're actually bringing about a transformation of at least one small part of the world. You know, your own life history is undergoing some sort of transformation, you know, through the process of thinking about whatever it is you're studying and trying to understand it better and so on. And then, you know, assuming that you go on to communicate what you've learned to other people, they will either adopt your position or tell you it's wrong and, you know, explain why and so on. So so those people's life histories, you know, is also altered by your experience of trying to understand whatever it is you tried to understand. So this, like, so I guess one way of putting this a little bit different terms than the way he puts it is that there's no sort of position outside the world that you can, like, look at the world from, that, you know, when we look at the world or try to understand the world, that is happening from inside the world, and that, you know, looking at the world process is itself transforming at least one part of the world. So it's that reflexive nature in a sense, but it's a kind of reflection that is not, it's different than, say, the kind of reflection that is like this sort of second order representation of something, in the sense that I can, like, I can have an experience of, looking at the table, and then I can, like, reflect on my experience. I can sort of, you know, what is it like to have this experience? I can consider that question. So that's a kind of, like, reflexivity in the sense of taking something that you were living through and turning that living through something itself into an experience. But here we have what I was describing earlier, the fact that when you change your perspective on the world, you're actually changing a part of the world. This is a different kind of reflexivity that doesn't involve like a second order or like a representation or something like that. I don't think we really have a good word for it. Reflexivity is probably not the right word to use for this, but there's like this, I don't have a good word for it, but I think this is like an important thing that he's sort of pointing to, even though he doesn't like make this sort of the focus of these remarks at the last part of the book, but just the fact that, even this sort of most abstract intellectual operation that you're just sort of doing in your study, trying to interpret Kant or whatever, this is still changing one region of the world. You're part of this transformation that the world is undergoing over the course of its history. So I think that is an important phenomenon that he's like sort of laid his finger on here. We need a better word than reflexivity on to describe that. If anyone has any suggestions, that would be very helpful.
Yeah, there's just so much in these last pages. I wanted to just talk for a second about the reference to Freud, so I didn't fully understand it, honestly. So I know he rejects, earlier in the book, he rejects this idea that, or he kind of recontextualizes this Freudian idea of what he calls a complex that, you know, as with cases of physical injury, for instance, causality, physical causality, or I guess psychological, I'm not sure what you would call it in the case of Freudian complex, causal influence on behavior only happens when something breaks down or some injury is not fully integrated into a higher dialectic. But he seems to be saying something a little bit different here, which is that there we can talk about something like a structure of the unconscious because there are aspects of the structure of our own behavior that can't be captured by the ideal significations which we try to use to understand that structure, or which can remain hidden from us, perhaps if we come to understand them and then also integrate them into our behavior, then, you know, we can, I guess, escape this causal determination by the complex and realize the higher dialectic, I guess. I don't know if that sounds right to you all.
Sorry, 1 second. That conversation again.
No problem.
So the Freud bit, like you said, he's pointing back to some of the, he only really discussed this like in like one or two paragraphs earlier in the book, but how exactly to interpret Freud's work, of course, is not that easy to decide. That, you know, he just the volume of it, of course, and the fact that a lot of his most important books were like restructured many times over the course of different editions and translation issues and so on. So there's a lot of things that make it hard to sort of pin down exactly what, you know, what is the best way to understand what Freud is doing. But like at least one level of interpretation or one way of interpreting Freud is in terms of an alternate kind of causal theory of behavior. So it would not be this physiological theory of behavior in terms of, you know, how the nervous system, you know, these sort of causal processes that are going on in the nervous system. Although Freud himself, you know, there's like the Entwurf is sort of presented in terms of the nervous system. But there was, you know, the knowledge of the functioning of the nervous system as he was writing that was fairly limited. But then, you know, later on, he sort of retreats from the more direct physiological accounts of behavior, and then he presents his, you know, sort of psychodynamic you know, accounts of behavior. So it's in terms of these processes that are going on in the mind that he sort of he assumes that these are, you know, things that are realized in some way in the human body. He doesn't hold that there's like a immaterial soul in which these psychological processes are happening. But he says that just in the state of science as it is now, we can't like explain the unconscious in terms of something that's happening in the brain. But it's a different kind of causal theory than, yeah, this like physiological one, but it's still a causal theory in the sense that you, if you want to know, like, why did I misremember the name of the author of this book or whatever, you would explain it in terms of, you know, the fact that the true name of the author that you couldn't remember is, you know, brings to mind some memory that you would rather not have brought to mind. And so you have like a process that represses the correct name of the author and brings up this alternate name instead. It's sort of like a sort of toy version of a Freudian explanation of a pyropraxis. Again, you're just explaining something that happened in your behavior in this causal term. In terms of this causal process, even though the causation here is a kind of psychological causation, and so like all the objections that Merleau-Ponty has raised to the physiological approach to explaining behavior could more or less be transferred over to like this sort of psychological causation, this, you know, psychodynamics you know, form of explanation of behavior. But he, at the same time, he doesn't want to sort of throw out everything that Freud presented, in the same way that he doesn't want to throw out everything that, you know, physiologists have done in studying behavior. So the question is, like, how can we make sense of the you know, Freudian account of pyropraxis, for example, or, you know, interpretation of dreams or whatever, without sort of adopting this causal mode of explanation? And so what he sort of very briefly sketches in this concluding passage is this idea that you would understand something like a complex or any of these phenomena that Freud depicts in these causal terms, you would understand this as a kind of signification. So the way he presents it here in this conclusion, I think maybe it's easier to understand if you sort of reversed the presentation. So he talks about like how, you know, understanding yourself and understanding another are similar kinds of things. But I think, so clearly we can misunderstand someone else's behavior. You can, you know, someone said something and you can interpret it as like they were trying to insult you, or when they were really talking about something completely different, and you just sort of got offended and angry for no reason. This is, you know, something that happens all the time. And what we can sort of suggest here is that this same kind of misinterpretation can also happen when we're trying to understand our own behavior. Though of course we, you know, have less opportunity for misunderstanding in relation to ourselves, or at least certain kinds of misunderstanding that arise in relation to other people are less likely to happen in relation to ourselves. So like the fact that this other person was actually referring to something else and a different person altogether is something that maybe you would have understood better if you had like been able to follow them around all day and hear what they were talking about and know what they had experienced and so on. So just the fact that you know, weren't there with them all day makes it, gives you the opportunity to misunderstand their remark as an insult directed towards you. Whereas, of course, with yourself, you are always there, you know, wherever you are having these experiences. So whatever, you know, allusions you're making to previous events or whatever, those are things that you you were there for the original event that you're alluding to, so you know what you were what you're talking about. But of course, there's other factors that are at work when we are trying to understand our own behavior that are not always at work in the case of understanding someone else. So like certain interpretations of my behavior are not necessarily flattering. They, you know, if I understand my behavior as being due to, you know, jealousy or greed or whatever, that is not something that makes me feel good about myself. So it's tempting to avoid that kind of interpretation of my behavior, which is, you know, less of a temptation in interpreting other people. But this is, but in any case, the idea here is that like these kinds of like whether I'm trying to understand someone else's behavior or trying to understand my own behavior, it's the same kind of process, even if the, you know, what exactly I'm using, what I'm basing that interpretation on, and you know, what kinds of factors can influence, you know, how I might misunderstand that behavior are different. And so like all of this is to sort of build up to this idea that like all these complexes and so on would be a result of misunderstanding ourselves. So not something like you know, this entity of some kind, this mysterious entity, the id, is like, you know, exerting these mysterious psychological forces that like push me to do certain things or to not do other things and so on. But instead, what we, you know, what Freud describes in these like psychodynamic terms can be understood as like a failure to understand the motives, understand my own motives, and to sort of integrate those motives into something that is coherent. So I find myself, I don't know, you get in an argument with someone that you care about and you say something cruel to that person in the heat of the moment and you regret it afterwards. You've sort of, you know, your impulse to, you know, make that cutting remark in the course of the argument is not sort of integrated with your larger project of building a relationship with this person of, you know, care and trust and so on. And so this is what, you know, these sort of unconscious, and this is sort of like a very simple example, but like this would be how you would try to understand the kinds of things that Freud describes as like, you know, unconscious drives bringing about or preventing certain kinds of behavior. And so like all these like, you know, more pathological cases that Freud describes of, you know, people that like, you know, like develop this like psychologically induced paralysis, you know, partial paralysis. They can't move their arm, for example. This is like sort of an extreme instance of something like this where like, because of like some traumatic experience or like, you know, unwillingness to accept what your true motives are, you sort of end up in this like trapped in this corner where like you can't move your arm is like your the way the sort of outcome of like not dealing with these motives that you don't want to acknowledge or something like that. So this is like a sort of a very sketchily outlined sort of reformulation of psychoanalysis that he's pointing to here. But he does talk, there's a chapter in Phenomenology of Perception that talks about sexuality, and of course it's like very heavily oriented towards like interpretation of Freud. He doesn't like, I think, do like a very sort of long, like large scale systematic sort of Freud interpretation, and it would be interesting to, you know, try to work that out more systematically.
Yeah, definitely. Unfortunately it looks like we probably don't have time to talk about the Marx stuff, but I guess we could probably spend a whole session on this conclusion just because it's so dense.
Yeah, like I said, it's like 20 books worth of material just like jammed into three paragraphs or three pages or whatever. If something comes to mind, you know, you can just put it on the in the forum section and we can discuss it over text. We're finished this book, and the next one that we had picked is Guyer's book, whose name I keep forgetting, but the cybernetics one that came out last year in translation. I posted the link in the forum section, I believe. We should probably make a new like subforum or whatever they're called for Rie. But next week, I'm going to be traveling on the weekend, so or out of town at least. And it's a good time, I think, to take a week off anyway, since we're between books. So we can come back on the 22nd at the same time and start on VA. I might, I'm gonna take a look if there's like a good short summary of like maybe like history of cybernetics that we can look at as like a maybe a preliminary reading, and then post that in the intervening 2 weeks. And we might like start with that instead of diving right into the book. But yeah, I'll see if I can find something that fits. And if not, we can just, you know, start with the book.
That's great. Yeah, that would be really helpful.
Cool. Okay. Yeah. So thanks everyone for your participation all along in this sort of mini epic. Not quite as epic as the Simondon individuation book in both volumes. Going through the whole history of Western philosophy in one of the appendices of that book. Yeah, it's still a pretty long-term commitment to get through this book, and yeah, like I was saying in the chat here, I feel like I got like way more out of this book by going through it together with everyone than when I just read it on my own like I guess maybe a year ago. So yeah, I definitely got a lot out of this group, and I hope everyone who participated and has been listening along has gotten something out of it as well.
Yeah, thanks, Nan. Yeah, I got a lot out of this book and really, really enjoyed it. Yeah, thank you. And thanks, everyone.
Cool. Okay. So see you all in 2 weeks.